This episode of The Greenpiece is supported by my friends at Immersion Journeys, an award-winning tour consultant based in New York City and your source for experiential luxury travel to Africa, South Asia, and way beyond. The Immersion Journeys brand has been built on the foundation that more than the sights, it is the experience. Immersion Journeys is also a proud supporter of Sabi Sabi Private Game Reserve. Immersion Journeys focuses on conscious luxury with an emphasis on positive community and conservation impact through travel. Their deep partnerships with select lodge groups such as Sabi Sabi Private Game Reserve, their selection of professional safari guides and creative trip itineraries provides their guests with unique experiences bar none. For more information, please contact Immersion Journeys on telephone number 917-686-2620 or check out their website at www.immersionjourneys.com. That's immersionjourneys.com. You can also drop them an email at info@immersionjourneys.com. Thanks for tuning into The Greenpiece, that's spelt P-I-E-C-E. I'm Warren Green, your host and one of the storytellers of this weekly podcast, where I'll be telling campfire stories about sustainable safaris, misadventures, and travel tales from around the world. I have a number of interesting people, including safari guides, conservationists, lodge managers, and philanthropists lined up to share their stories and expertise with you. So, grab yourself a beverage, sink back into a comfortable chair, and enjoy the next half an hour with me. Today's podcast is the first of a series of four podcasts, four conversations with characters out of Mozambique who are doing some of the most extraordinary things. I think you're going to find it fascinating. First, a little bit of history. Mozambique is a country of around about 310,000 square miles. It's got a coastline of around about 1,600 miles long, and it's got a population of around 30 million people. It's probably the poorest, if not very close to the bottom of the ladder, country in the world, which is not because of its rich mineral deposits or healthy natural resources. It's unfortunately due to the fact that it's been plagued by unrest and wars over the last 50 or so years. Initially a war of independence from Portuguese rule, to more recently a civil war between Renamo and Frelimo. Renamo was centered up in the Sofala province around an area known as Ngorongosa, which was the headquarters and the training ground for Renamo troops. Ngorongosa was also the jewel of Mozambique. It was a hugely diverse national park with rich landscapes and ecosystems, but in an area about the size of Belgium. And that was all but obliterated during the Civil War. Reasons for that, I suppose, were poaching. The wealth of elephants and their ivory were used to fund the war, and people used the park as a breadbasket. And of course, the park being a training ground where live ammunition was regularly used meant that things got obliterated just because. So Ngorongosa has a fascinating history. It's got a wonderful, rich past, and unfortunately in the recent past, not such a great story to tell. However, that was until late in the 90s, early 2000, when the Carr Foundation got involved. That's a story on its own. That's the story that we're going to tell. But just the thumbnail for you is Greg Carr, who's the founder of the Carr Foundation, meets up with an ambassador from Mozambique who discusses the beautiful country that he represents. Carr gets to meet the president of the country, who invites him to come over and invest in it. You know, Greg Carr is a guy who has human rights fore and center. And so he decides to come over and have a look at Mozambique. He flies over in a helicopter and is absolutely blown away, excuse the pun, by the sensational beauty of Mozambique. He's introduced to Gorongosa and again is completely stunned by the landscape and visualizes what it must have been like during its glory days, and has this dream of restoring it to its former glory, and pledges to invest $40 million over a 20-year period, restoring the park to what it is today. In fact, not even to what it is today. It's going to go way beyond where Greg has brought it to, where his organization has brought it to. And I'm very cautious to use the word organization, because when I initially wanted to speak to Greg, he discouraged me, saying that it was the members of his team that were more important than him. They were doing a phenomenal job on the ground, and it is their story that needs to be told as well, and in particular. So I'm very cautious of referring to Greg as the individual. He does have a remarkable team of people that is working and creating this Gorongosa project, whom we are going to meet and talk to during this four-part series. I'd like to kick off by asking you to take note of two web addresses, gorongosacoffee.com and gorongosa.org. Please follow along, have a look at those websites, and particularly the coffee website, where you'll understand why it's so important that you drink a cup of Gorongosa coffee in the morning. It goes a lot further than just giving you that wake-up shot that you need. It supports school kids, it supports hospitals, clinics, it supports myriad activities around Gorongosa National Park. Ultimately is a fulcrum in the development of Gorongosa National Park.
Warren, how are you?
Hey, Greg, I'm really well, man. How about you?
Well, I'm really glad you reached out. You know, it's so helpful in these strange quarantine days for people to stay connected. So thank you for thinking of that.
Greg, it's absolutely my pleasure. And so what I want to do is just set the scene, because you and I would most probably prefer to have this conversation sitting on the banks of Lake Urema with a cup of Gorongosa coffee while we watch the slow embers of an African fire burn and the morning chorus of those birds and hardy-dars and guinea fowl and Franklin's starting the day for us. That's probably where we would prefer to be.
I've got the image now, and I added some crown cranes, so we're in good shape.
Okay, well, that's fantastic, because this is a conversation that's intended to be just like that, out in the wilderness and discovering more about Gorongosa and yourself. So I'm going to, because I know time for you is precious, we're going to dive right in. Hey, Greg, and I want to address the elephant in the room before we get underway. How are you able to get a tea drinking nation to plant and start to drink coffee?
Well, that's a wonderful question. So what I love about the Mozambicans is they are eager to learn. They're hard workers. They're honest. They're good people. I'm sure you may know that for 500 years now, Mozambique has been known as Terra de Boa Gente, land of the good people. Mm. And so we did go up to Mount Gorongosa into the rainforest, and these were some of the poorest people in the world. I honestly, Warna, it's hard to even describe to you, but when I first went there, frankly, a lot of them didn't have clothing, or they had made clothing for themselves, you know, out of the bark of trees. And they were eating, I mean, they were trapping cane rats and insects and such. I mean, you know, they had suffered so much through really a generation of war, not, you know, two wars, actually. And we said, we'll hire you to plant trees. And we will start with a small nursery. You know, we need little saplings. And I don't think they did know what coffee was, but they certainly knew what a job was, and they certainly know how to plant trees. And so off we went. And now, well, what is it, 6-7 years later, you know, they're harvesting the coffee, processing it, and tasting it. And they're so proud, and they're making more money than they've ever seen in their life. But they're also getting another benefit, which is they are seeing the trees on their mountain come back, and they love the trees, and they don't want a mountain without trees. So the coffee project provides income and is restoring the rainforest.
Well, it's absolutely genius, because I suppose Mount Gorongosa once was a beautifully forested rainforest, and through those devastating wars, people needed to sustain themselves off the land. So what, they deforested the place to create arable ground to plant crops? Is that about right?
Yeah, one thing that happened during the war is it was a terrible, terrible war, and people were hiding. They had to hide. And so a lot of people who were not actually from Mount Gorongosa, you know, who had not lived up there for centuries or millennia, Mozambicans from other places went to hide on Mount Gorongosa from the war. So that brought a lot of new people in. And so, yeah, they were cutting the trees to plant maize and to plant potatoes. And I fully understand that. I'm going to feed my family, too. Whatever it takes. So when we came along and said, look, we don't want you to go anywhere. We're glad you're here. We know you love this mountain. We know you love the trees and the forest. We just have an idea for you to make money where you'll make a lot more money than potatoes. Grow trees with us. And we pay them not only to plant coffee trees, but we pay them to plant the native rainforest trees as well, because we all know that the best coffee grows under shade because the berries ripen more slowly and they're more flavorful. So you want to plant your coffee trees among native rainforest trees. And so this group of magnificent Mozambicans are planting coffee trees and rainforest trees. And I'll also mention that coffee is native to Africa. We all know that. And there's distant cousins of the coffee tree, you know, other plants in the same family already on Mount Gorongosa. So we were not introducing an exotic or an invasive or something like that. And the end of the very happy story is that, we're restoring that rainforest. People are getting a livelihood, but it's more than a livelihood, because let's remember a really important fact. These people tie their spirituality to that mountain and to those trees. So they will say, and Pedro Magura, who's a local person, speaks several local languages, Pedro Magura will say, we're restoring our souls when we restore Gorongosa National Park.
Oh, that's fantastic. Pedro's the warden who's largely been responsible for planting so many of those trees. Is that?
Yeah. Pedro is born in the region, speaks the local languages, several of them, and loves trees, understands them, loves to teach other people to plant trees. And so he's kind of been the spirit of this project. And I just love Pedro Magura. He's just, you listen to him talk and you see his face, and it's just a warmth that envelops you.
So you've come in to Gorongosa and you're planting coffee. That I'm sure was nowhere near your sights or vision when you first moved in the mid-2000s.
Well, yeah, thanks for the question. So I was invited to Gorongosa by the president of the country. The president of Mozambique at that time was Chissano. Mm. And Chissano loves national parks, but he loves national parks in a deeper way than just enjoying elephants or lions or something. He loves national parks because he knows that wild areas are the soul and the spirituality of his nation. And he wanted to see Gorongosa Park restored, but he wanted to see Gorongosa Park help the local people who live there. It's their national park. It's their biological heritage. And I'm not a biologist. I wasn't trained in conservation. President Chissano invited me to Mozambique because of my background in business, creating jobs, and my background in human rights and helping people. And he said to me, I want a national park that's oriented toward the people who live in the greater region. So I showed up with that mission, thinking about healthcare, thinking about schools, things like that. As far as my knowledge of conservation, I just actually went on a massive reading spree. For quite a few years, I started with Professor E.O. Wilson of Harvard. I read more than a dozen of his books. But then I kind of read through a lot of the what you might think of as the conservation canon. I mean, going all the way back to Emerson, and Thoreau, mm-hmm. and Rachel Carson and Aldo Leopold and so forth, and just reading through that literature. But of course, that still doesn't make me a professional ecologist. So I hired a wonderful man from South Africa named Mark Stallmans.
Yes.
And one of Mark's first observations was, Greg, Mount Gorongosa is the water catchment. It is the source of water for all of Gorongosa Park, but more than that, for a couple hundred thousand people who depend on that rain to come and the rivers to flow so that they can have farms. And if you lose all of the trees on Mount Gorongosa, the rain would actually stop falling because trees create rain. I mean, it's an amazing statistic. But in a single year, a single rainforest tree evaporates hundreds of gallons of water. Now, someone who's a scientist will know the real number, and I'm giving you my round number. But let's just say a single tree sends up so much water every year. Now, imagine a million trees. Imagine 10 million trees. What's going on? So the point is that Mount Gorongosa sends, the moisture evaporates into the air, creates clouds, and then that cloud rains right back down again. So Mount Gorongosa is creating its own weather. If you lost all the trees, that hydrological cycle would stop. And then the farmers who live downstream would all suffer. So Mark Stallmans, being an ecologist and actually did his PhD specifically on trees and forests, said, Greg, we need to save that rainforest. And obviously the best way to save the rainforest is to have all the people who live in the rainforest benefit from it. In fact, it's the only way to save the rainforest. So that one thing led to another, and I'm now moving through, a couple of years of time, but that brings us to Pedro Magura and the idea to grow coffee, and everybody wins.
Greg, it's absolutely fascinating, and I'm particularly amused is the wrong word. I've looked at the South African national park system, which seems to have replicated itself throughout Africa, and I suppose in its essence it is developed to protect biodiversity and keep humanity on its periphery, or even beyond its periphery, outside the park completely. You've taken that and actually destroyed the paradigm and created something completely different. You've created a park for the people, by the people, of the people, and benefiting directly from the park, even by living within it at this point. Obviously, they're going to be not forced out, but they're going to move their way outside of the park as the economies beyond the park's borders become more viable and sustainable. I just think that it's a remarkable vision to be able to go in this new millennium with this whole new approach to conserving a park. It's phenomenal.
Well, Warren, I guess you're originally from South Africa, if I'm not mistaken. This idea of a new style of national park comes before my time. It comes from some very brilliant people, and one of them is Nelson Mandela.
Yeah.
After being in prison in Robben Island for 27 years, when Mandela got out of prison in, I think, 1990, he didn't become president of South Africa until 1994. Correct. During those 4 years, he spent a lot of time outdoors, as you'd expect after being locked up for 27 years. Yeah. He spent a lot of time in national parks and reserves in South Africa, which he loved, but he made the observation straight away. He said, these national parks are not helping people, and they need to. We need to see one holistic picture here, where where nature is helping people, people are helping nature. It's one big harmonious, integrated success story. And you know, Millicent Nunn Miller wasn't the only person to see that, but he was early in seeing that. You know, that's more than a quarter century ago. He's making that observation. And he was friends with the man I already mentioned, President Chissano of Mozambique. Yep. And so when I came along, I mean, I felt as if this is the mandate that I was given. And there's other people, Wangari Maathai, you know, who won the Nobel Peace Prize for her vision of people and nature, and other visionary people and Africans. Let's underscore that. Africans have always seen people and nature living together. So it was really an old style, you might call it 20th century, frankly, even 19th century view of a national park, that a national park has these hard borders, and it's, you know, all the animals live here and all the people live somewhere else and so forth. But in the 20th century, in the 21st century, we now have a more enlightened way of looking at it, that these ecosystems need to help people. And the most vulnerable people in the world are people who tend to live in the most remote areas. In other words, you know, near a national park. And if those people are benefiting from the park, then they're going to support the park. And they're not going to need to poach an animal if their belly is full. So let's help them with their farms. Let's help them with schools. And Gorongosa, we work in 50 schools right now, with thousands and thousands of children all around the national park. And we just got a grant we're really excited about from the United States government. We're going to build 40 brand new, beautiful primary schools. I couldn't be more thrilled about that. So, I do think it's a new view. I don't take credit for it. I'm happy to be on the team, but it is a view that needs to win in the 21st century that, yes, we need to protect biodiversity. Yes, we need rainforests. But we need greater ecosystems where humans thrive as well. And the humans can thrive in what we call a green economy. Some people call it a conservation economy. And that's a set of employment opportunities that are based on a sustainable use of the natural resources that are there. Ecotourism is a great example. Growing coffee or growing cashew is a great example. Honey, you know, that we support thousands of farm families by giving them beehives, and then they produce honey and they make money, and then we process the honey. And once again, everybody wins. Forestry can be managed in a sustainable way. And we now own a forest near Gorongosa Park, and we employ people in that forestry. Fishing obviously can be done in a sustainable way. So let's imagine greater Gorongosa, and I don't just mean the Gorongosa National Park boundaries. Let's imagine greater Gorongosa, an area about two-thirds the size of Belgium, as a green economy that has protected its biodiversity, where you do have elephants and you do have lions, but you've got several hundred thousand people living a life, you know, not in poverty, but a nice middle-class life. That's our vision. We're working, we're making progress. And I'm just going to add one more piece to this puzzle, Warren, and that is, I just talked about a series of businesses based on the sustainable use of natural resources, whether it's forestry, tourism, honey, cashew, coffee, you name it. Well, I'm going to add one more piece to that economic puzzle. All those businesses I just mentioned are owned by something called the Gorongosa Trust. Now, yes. The Gorongosa Trust does not have any shareholders. It is not a for-profit business. The Gorongosa Trust takes all the money and puts it right back into the community. That's why we are able to pay for after-school clubs, for girls and boys. That's why we are able to pay for health interventions, and frankly, to pay for the scientists who protect the elephants. So Someone who's drinking Goran Gosa coffee is not only saving an ecosystem, not only creating jobs for Mozambican people, they are actually funding girls in school, funding the protection of elephants.
Yeah, phenomenal. I mean, I never needed another excuse to have a second cup of coffee in the morning, but you've just given me a fine one, hey, Greg.
I don't know who all listens to your outstanding podcast here, Warren, but if there are people listening and they're curious, it's very simple. Go to gorongosacoffee.org and you'll learn about this from a variety of people, and most of them are more intelligent than I am.
Not as visionary, though. I was just wanting to ask you, I mean, yes, the coffee has come along at an opportune time, particularly for small business development around that park. Are you not concerned about the ultimate goal of getting tourists into the park? I sometimes feel that you've been way ahead of your game in developing the park and hoping that tourists would come through the gates as soon as you opened them. Has that taken a little longer than you'd expected? Are there plans to, I suppose, accelerate the arrival of tourists? I mean, COVID aside?
Yeah, I'm glad that you asked that question. This quarantine time here, I happen to be in Idaho, has given me a lot of time to plan with my colleagues. Another one of those colleagues is a man named Matt Jordan, who's also quarantined here in Idaho. So we've been sitting, 6 feet apart, but we've been sitting with whiteboards, and one of our topics has been the tourism business. And what Matt Jordan and I are going to do is we're going to invest $10 million to build some luxury tourism lodges. And we know exactly where we want them because we know the ecosystem so well. We're going to build something we call a coffee lodge. So people can go up in the beautiful rainforest of Mount Gorongosa. They could even harvest their own coffee, and they could go birding and go hiking. We're going to have two luxury, what they call luxury tented camps in the core of Gorongosa, where you will hear a lion roaring at night, and you'll be by a river or by a lake. Mm-hmm. One of those luxury camps is about halfway finished now. It's called Muzimu, which Muzimu means spirit in the local language. Mm-hmm. Obviously, we had to slow down our construction during this time of the pandemic, but then we'll speed up that construction. We'll start a new camp next year on a beautiful little lake. And what we're looking for is I guess what people in the African safari ecotourism industry think of as kind of a middle high end. Yeah. And what I mean by that is not super, super high end luxury where you have to have a $20 million lodge and, you know, it's really a pretty big footprint on an ecosystem. We're not going to do that, you know, and the prices for those, you know, can really be scary, you know, more than $1,000, more than $2,000 a night per person. We're going for, what they call luxury tented camp, luxury in canvas. So you have a beautiful, comfortable bed. You have a wonderful hot shower. You know, you have those things that you expect, but you're in a tent, you know, but you'll be walking on beautiful wood that we've grown sustainably in the Gorongosa ecosystem. You'll have a Mozambican guide who will take you out. That guide, there's at least a 50% chance that that guide's going to be a woman. We hire 50% women in Gorongosa National Park. It's another one of our human rights approaches to the park. Mm-hmm. And I am excited about that. We will be able to open Muzimu next year. And then in following years, these other luxury tented camps I'm talking about. And absolutely, tourism needs to be a big part of our strategy. With the number of tourism beds that we've outlined now, we will create about 300 jobs. And in Africa, you know what that really means. 300 jobs is 300 extended families. You know, it's because Africans share and they're so wonderful to each other. You know, that is a lot of people who will benefit.
Yeah, I've always figured that for every one person involved, employed, you're affecting the lives of 10 others. So through those 300 jobs, you're really changing the lifestyles for 3,000 people, which is absolutely phenomenal.
Well, very much so. And then those 3,000 people that you're talking about, they have to go to the store and buy something, and that helps, you know, somebody else. And so you create an economic flywheel, so to speak, where the benefits actually just keep flowing. Some people say that a rand or a dollar or a metica, whatever currency you want to use, they say, you know, it'll get spent five times, right? Because, you know, somebody earns a salary, they buy something, whoever they bought it from buys something, and it just keeps going.
In economic terms, don't they call that the multiplier effect?
Yes.
There we go.
Yeah, more technical term than the one I invented here, economic flywheel.
Well, that's spot on, hey, Greg. You know, when you mentioned the levels of luxury, it did strike a chord with me because, yes, I think a lot of the safari industry has got itself preoccupied with granite hand basins and brass covered or gold plated taps with outlets, when really truly the luxury is being in the wilderness. That is the beautiful part. That is the luxury. That is where the experience is to be had.
When you're sitting on the bank of a river at sunset and you are watching, literally hundreds of yellow-billed storks come in to roost. And off in the distance, you might hear a hippo or you might hear a lion. And then as the sun does set, and the first thing you see in the sky is Venus, and then shortly after that, you see Jupiter, and then you see the southern sky, and you see the Milky Way like you've never seen it before. And you have your favorite beverage in your hand and your lover next to you. Do you really care exactly what chair is in the room behind you? If there's a fancy painting on the wall? I don't think so. The fancy painting is 4 billion years of evolution that this planet has created for our beauty.
Yeah, you are so spot on. You're so spot on. And that evolution was almost stopped in its tracks by the Civil War. And you've taken on a bunch of scientists. I remember meeting some of them out at your home in Idaho who were giving you feedback on the various discoveries that they'd been making in Gorongosa. How many species are you up to having rediscovered or found returning to the park since you've been active there?
Yeah, it's a lot of fun, Warren, you know, and you bring up another important point, which is in the quirky early history of national park culture, even scientists weren't all that welcome. It was kind of like we just want animals and rangers looking at them or something. I'm being a little bit silly, but you know what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
It wasn't all that easy to get a research permit for a scientist. And we said, well, Gorongosa needs to be a knowledge engine. It's an opportunity for the whole world to learn more about the way ecosystems function. And so we invited scientists from around the world to come to Gorongosa. And just in the past few years, I don't have a complete number, but just in the past few years, we've had more than 30 universities doing research in Gorongosa from all over the world. And let me mention that includes Mozambican universities. And we have launched something that we call a biodiversity inventory. In other words, we're trying to identify every species that you can find in Gorongosa National Park. Now, it will take decades, but I can tell you this, since we've started, we've already identified more species in Gorongosa National Park than any other park in Africa. And we have discovered a lot of species that are completely new. In other words, before now, you know, they didn't have, you know, they weren't registered with a Latin name and all of that. So species, yeah. as the term they use is a species new to science. The species may not be new to the local people of Gorongosa. They probably know all about it, but it's new to science. So the rest of the world didn't know about it. So we're proud of that. And this new species we find include vertebrates as well as invertebrates, you know, a new frog, a new fish, you know, a new bat or a bat that maybe hadn't been seen in 100 years. You know that there's a cave, there's a single cave in Gorongosa National Park where in that one cave, our scientists found 26 different bat species. I mean, the level of biodiversity is beyond anyone's imagination. So the science is important, but there's something else that the science does, which is that it does give a training opportunity to young Mozambicans. We have a master's program. We conduct a 2-year master's in conservation biology in Gorongosa Park. It's the only, to my knowledge, the only 2-year master's program in the world taught entirely inside, immersed in a national park. And we just graduated this past January, 12 Mozambicans, women and men, with these degrees. We hired some of them, some other national parks in Mozambique hired some of them. A few of them are going to go teach in universities. And now we've started our next cohort. So it's something else about a national park is that it's we like to use the term, it's an education engine for Mozambique and for the world.
Well, congratulations on those numbers, Greg. I mean, that is phenomenal. A friend of mine who is a university teacher over this side of the world has been talking to me recently about the school or the classroom environment and commenting on how the COVID isolation has forced universities to start doing things online. And he reckons that the future of education is going to be exactly what you've just said. It's got to be out in situation where people are experiencing and learning from the environment that they are studying. And that's beyond just the walls of conservation.
It's absolutely essential. You know, one of our young Mozambican women who earned her master's degree studied the lungfish. I mean, lungfish. Imagine it's a 400 million year old species. It's one of those early links where creatures from the sea came out on land. We still have lungfish in Gorongosa. You know, she's not going to study that in a classroom in a book. She was standing, ankle deep in water with boots, collecting real lungfish to study them. And, another one of the young women who earned a master's degree with us studied honey and the best way to help local people create high quality honey and to avoid, obviously, you know, pests and things like that. You have to be in the real world, certainly if you're studying conservation or ecology or any of those topics. And unfortunately, in Mozambique, before our master's program came along, you did see a lot of students, let's say, in the capital city earning a degree in biology, and they had never had a field day. You know, they just didn't have the opportunity. And we have not only this master's program that I have mentioned, but we do more than that. We run workshops all year long where scores of young Mozambicans who might be undergraduate students can come and get some time in the field. We need this knowledge. We're going to have a tough century. You know, we got to be honest about it. This is 2020. You look out between now and the year 2100. It's going to be a challenge for the earth. We do have climate change. We are going to have more droughts. We're going to have more cyclones. We're going to lose biodiversity. We may lose crops that we depend on for our food and livelihoods. Mm. So we're going to have a tough century. And the way to get through this century is going to be to have a lot of people trained in conservation biology, conservation agriculture, hydrology, you know, you name it. but people who will know how to switch to a different coffee cultivar that will grow in a drier climate, or how to save certain wild seeds that we may need for diversity, so that we aren't just depending upon a handful of crops for everything we eat. So, conservation biology and its cousin disciplines are essential for us on this planet to get through the next 80 years.
That is a shocking and staggering statement, hey Greg, and it's I suppose you're lucky to be doing this project in Africa, where essentially you've got all the raw materials, i.e. you've got the raw land to work with and restore, and you've got the resilient population that have seen so much adversity that a day of hard work is really something that they take in their stride. And you and I think understand what I mean by a day of hard work. Those people are such hardy souls. And I'm thinking in the context of North America, where we have kind of evolved into a much softer way of life, where, you know, we've almost destroyed all of our natural biomes that can sustain us into the future, and given that up for vast amounts of agricultural land where everything's mechanized, and in a sense we've divorced ourselves from the dependency of the earth in a sort of quirky kind of way.
Well, you know, and there's one piece of good news, I think, for all of us, Warren, and that is nature is resilient, and it is possible to rewild. And you can take an area, of course, your original country, South Africa, has done this successfully. You can take an area that has been under cultivation, and perhaps the yields are really not that great, and, you know, there's not adequate water, and you can let it go wild again. And nature knows what to do. And Gorongosa has healed itself when people stopped taking the animals, taking the trees, and so forth. So we can be optimistic. And this is something that a lot of scientists are studying as they watch Gorongosa rewild itself. They're looking at the new equilibriums that are created between herbivores and predators, or between plants and herbivores. And so it's a great natural experiment. A lot of papers are being published. But we can be hopeful that even really distressed areas can be brought back. A friend of mine works in Montana, which is the state next door here, and he and his very large group of talented people have a project called the American Prairie, and they are rewilding a big part of Montana and bringing back the original prairie. And that means buffalo and foxes, and you know, how exciting is that?
Fantastic, yeah.
Yeah, we're learning, you know, we're learning how to get tremendous crop yields actually on less land, means that some land can go back to nature even as we keep raising more and more food, because we are smart and we do have good technology and we do know things. And I can imagine the United States 80 years from now, the end of this century, I can imagine that we actually have more wilderness areas, and that places like Yellowstone have a corridor to places like Glacier National Park. I can imagine that happening even as we continue to feed ourselves, because I am a believer in human ingenuity, human technology, and getting more on the area, on the land that we have.
Well, clearly you're a believer, Greg. I mean, I'm amazed at what you've achieved over, 15 years with Gorongosa, starting off with essentially what I might term a dust bowl, and now having restored a large proportion of the animals back. I mean, you've certainly not achieved a carrying capacity yet. And I suppose that's infinite, as Gorongosa itself will expand and merge with other national parks. You've definitely figured out the right recipe to make it work.
Well, I'm particularly happy to tell you that 98% of our employees are Mozambican. And this is a Mozambican success story. And a lot of the departments of Gorongosa, you know, we have six different departments. A lot of the departments are 100% Mozambican. There's not a single, you know, expat or international person working there. I mean, and we have 260 rangers, and I want to give a shout out to them. They work so hard, and we have women rangers and men rangers, and they will collect traps, you know, these nasty traps that get set in the ecosystem, and a lion steps in it. And for a while there, most of our lions only had three legs, and frankly, that's just sad, you know, and it's wrong. But our rangers have collected the traps and what are called snares, you know, little wire devices. They've collected more than 20,000 of them. How do you like that? Wow. And then the flip side of that story is to say, well, who was trying to trap something? Well, the person that was trying to trap something is somebody who has a farm nearby. And because we help them with their farm, they can have plenty of food. I mentioned our cash crops like coffee, cashew, honey, but we also help thousands of families with their regular food crops, whether it's maize or other kinds of cereals, plus beans and legumes. And we help them with that. So if you've got plenty of food outside your front door, you don't need to take a dangerous trip for 20 kilometers, you know, somewhere and set a trap and see whether or not you catch something. So helping the farmers is a big part of what we do. So I'm just proud of everyone on our team, but it is a Mozambican success story.
Absolutely, Greg. You mentioned helping those subsistence farmers. What does the aid look like that you're providing them?
Well, so first of all, these are people who do know how to farm, and they know how to work hard, but if you can be in what's called a poverty trap, you know, you just don't have the resources to lift yourself out. So in other words, they'll use the same seeds over and over again, year after year, and the seeds gradually have, you know, less yield. So we can give them better seeds, they'll just get more yield from the same amount of work. We can also train young farmers in methods. You know, every young person, I don't care if you're African or American or whoever you are. I mean, every young person needs some training. So we can train young farmers in row cropping where you get a better yield. We can provide them foot pumps to bring water into their field at certain critical times. We can also train them to mulch at the end of the year. Instead of burning what's left of their maize stubble, it's much better to actually mulch it. Then your soil will be more fertile and more productive. But the things I'm talking about cost money, and you can say, well, hey, Greg, those are all fine ideas. I don't have an extra penny, you know. So you need to sometimes give somebody a little boost. Just a little bit of money goes a long way. And then the next year they make a lot more money on their farm, and then they're off and running. So that old saying you and I have heard all our lives, a hand up, not a hand out. And these are hardworking people that just need a little bit, and off they go.
And I absolutely agree. So you help them get the right crop in the ground, and then once the crop gets harvested, they've got to earn some money from that crop. How are they getting that crop to new markets, for example? I mean, you're talking about a community that doesn't have money. Who are they selling their stuff to?
Well, I can tell you are well informed in this, because you're asking a question that may not be obvious, you know, to everyone, but you hit it on the head. Let's say you're a farmer in the very remote area, and you have succeeded. You know, you've raised a lot of maize, you've raised some beans, maybe a few vegetables. That's all wonderful. How do you get that to market? And what you don't want to happen is a middleman, let's say, from the city, who really just wants to make money and doesn't have your interests at heart. Can drive through with his his truck and offer you a price that's a low price. And the problem is you don't have an alternative. And you're saying, well, my fruit or vegetables are going to rot in the field, or I sell it to this guy. So that's an unfortunate situation. So we do help our farmers to access what's called the value chain, meaning, you know, getting money for crops beyond just the commodity value. So we can help them get their crop to market and get a fair price. And that's something that we do in our, I mentioned we have six departments in Gorongosa. One of them is called the Department of Sustainable Development. And so we have people in that department who help the farmers get a fair price. And it is a critical part of the story.
Yeah, I'm sure it is. I mean, that's the value in it. And then, Greg, I mean, okay, so here you are. You've come in, you've restored their park, you've given them the wherewithal to earn an income. And now you bring in elephants, and not just one elephant, you bring in a couple of, you know, a dozen elephants. And those elephants need land to roam. Sometimes they're ill-disciplined and they break out of the park and they go and raid a crop. Surely that creates some anxiety in the communities and distrust and distaste. How do you deal with those situations?
That may actually be I put that in the top five, maybe the top three issues that we're going to worry about for the coming decades. And it is a topic where people have to stop for a moment and really think carefully. Elephants are big, and in one night, an elephant could walk into my farm and eat all of my maize and beans. And I have lost a year's worth of work, and my family goes hungry. Mm. So, you know, when I talk, and I talked earlier in this conversation about people and nature, you know, living in harmony and so forth. Yes, that's true. But we can't sugarcoat that. We can't say that and imply that there aren't challenges or tricky parts to that puzzle. There are, and elephants are one of them. We would love to have 2,000 elephants again in Gorongosa National Park. That's how many we had before the war and before the elephants were slaughtered for their ivory and ivory traded for weapons. We would love to have 2,000 elephants again. However, those elephants need to stay inside the park. Yeah. They cannot walk over the river at night and eat someone's farm. So what are you going to do? We have a woman, a Mozambican woman. Her name is Dominique Gonçalves. She's about 28, 29 years old. She's a National Geographic Fellow. She's her PhD in the United Kingdom in elephant ecology. Mm-hmm. And this is what she studies, is where do these elephants move? What time of year are they moving around? Why are they moving around? And she identifies the elephants that are most likely to go outside the park. And it's actually the big males, the big bull elephants. The females with their babies are less likely to go outside the park. And she takes those big bull elephants and she darts them, puts them to sleep for a few minutes and puts a collar around them so she can keep track of them. And when that elephant walks outside the park, she can get a signal. And then we have a series of mechanisms for bringing that elephant back into the park. Rangers can try to scare them back in the park. We've actually used fireworks before. In certain areas, we can put up beehives because the elephants do not like bees. But no one solution is going to work, or no one solution is going to work, you know, all year long and every season. So it's an ongoing effort. And Dominique, being a young person and being brilliant, may spend a good proportion of her entire professional career on this issue because she loves elephants. She wants a large herd of happy elephants, but she also wants safe, happy farmers and farms next to it. So I'm not going to say this is just an easy problem or, you know, and I think that it's an example where we have to recognize that there is such a thing as large, intact wilderness. And what I mean by that is, if you want elephants living on this planet, if you want lions, if you want hippos, if you want crocodiles, if you want Cape buffalo, If you want these large species living free on this planet and not just in zoos, then you do have to give them a space to live. And so you do need national parks. And every so often I hear someone question even the very concept of national park. And I say, no, sorry. Yes, we need national parks. Now, we might change the behavior of a national park, as we have discussed in this entire hour here. National parks are going to take care of their neighbors. National parks are going to be better neighbors. Yes. So we'll change the behavior of national parks. That's not the same as saying we don't need a national park, because guess what? Elephants need a place to live, and I don't want it to be in a one-acre enclosure in a zoo. There's something else that nobody wants in conservation, and that's fences. You know, the whole idea of wilderness is, you know, it's wild. And so I would never want to put a fence all around Gorongosa National Park. And it's not healthy either, because that would imply that you can't have a genetic diversity. You know, you need DNA transfer from one wilderness area to another.
Yes.
But you have to be a pragmatist and not an ideologue if you're going to get involved in conservation. And what I mean by that is, on the southern border of Gorongosa National Park, we are going to have to put a fence. You know, I don't love the idea, but guess what? We're going to have to do it, because there are so many people living just on the other side of that border. However, we're lucky, because we will not need a fence on our eastern border, because that eastern border is largely free of any human communities all the way to the Indian Ocean.
Wow.
And north all the way to the Zambezi River. So isn't that exciting? I mean, you want natural boundaries. Zambezi River is a natural boundary. The Indian Ocean is a natural boundary. So the good news is that greater Gorongosa, not just the national park boundaries, can extend without fences. So an elephant that lives over next to the Indian Ocean may someday, you know, make a girlfriend with an elephant that lives in Gorongosa National Park. Well, that's healthy, and we need that. But yes, we actually, part of our planning process we've been doing in quarantine, we've allocated up to almost $1 million to build a fence on the southern border of the park, because we need to keep elephants out of people's farms.
Yeah. Tragically, that is true. But Craig, you've just mentioned something that really got my ears up. Everything to the east is unpopulated. Is there a specific reason for that?
Yeah, it's because when you go east of Gorongosa Park and you head toward the Indian Ocean, the land is quite sandy and dry.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't get the same amount of rainfall that the western side of the park gets, the park I talked about earlier in this discussion, where we have Mount Gorongosa and the rainforest. Going east, there's not a lot of surface water in the dry season, and so families really can't live there. So there are very few families. It's great animal, you know, wildlife habitat. So we do have an opportunity to have a corridor to the Indian Ocean. Now, that does not mean that Gorongosa Park's boundaries need to extend that far. By no means do we need to do that. In conservation, we think of a mosaic of different kind of protected area. I mentioned earlier forestry. We have sustainable forest businesses between Gorongosa Park and the Indian Ocean, where you can create a product and economic activity with sustainable forestry. But well-managed forests are extremely compatible for wildlife corridors. And we work closely now with these forests, and, you know, there's leopards moving through there at night and so forth. So we have a chance to envision a greater Gorongosa that will extend to the Indian Ocean. But still recognize there are different kinds of land categories. You know, there's reserves, there's forests, there's national park. There's different ways to put an ecosystem like this together.
Yeah, sure. And of course, you can you know, your land use can change along the way to support whatever humanity needs to be supported from it.
Well, that's right. And for instance, one of these forest concessions I mentioned has a couple hundred employees, but they don't need to live in that forest. They can live in a safer place in a town where they're not going to have an elephant walking through their backyard, and then do what other people in this world do: take a bus to work, and work in the forest, and then go home. So. Forestry is very compatible with what we're trying to achieve. Certain kinds of agriculture are very compatible with what we're trying to achieve.
Yeah, and forestry, I mean, that's key. I was just thinking about Ida that came through, was it this year? No, last year, that horrible cyclone that hit you guys. And it seems to me that tract of land that you've just spoken of to the east of Gorongosa would be a natural sponge for these tropical storms that come off the Indian Ocean. Forestry becomes a place where vast amounts of water can be very quickly absorbed. So that's just linking back to saving it all by reforesting.
Well, you're right. Our science team was monitoring Cyclone Idai, from satellite imagery, and Gorongosa became an enormous lake during that cyclone, mm-hmm. and captured, I don't know how many, tens of thousands of Olympic swimming pools worth of water. But that's a great benefit to the people that live downstream who would have been washed out, yes. Even worse than they were. I mean, there was sadly a lot of flooding and a lot of harm, mm-hmm. but it would have been worse if mm-hmm. Gorongosa had not acted as a giant sponge and collected that water. And this is what's also wonderful about a large intact wilderness, a truly functioning natural system, is that it benefits you in a flood because it absorbs water. But guess what? It also benefits you in a drought because it retains water retains moisture and shade. So in the age of climate change that is upon us, large forests, large national parks, and so forth, they mitigate the extremes of climate change, whether it's drought, we're going to have more drought years and we're going to have more flood years. And big natural areas ameliorate that.
Mm. Well, one of the striking features of Gorongosa is Lake Urema. It's one of those pictures that I first saw of the project, and I was quite stunned at it, both its enormity and its stunning beauty. Over the 15, 16 years that you've been involved there, have you noticed if that lake has increased in size or sustained its water levels for longer into the year than in the past? Well, I suppose you couldn't really make a comparison, but from when you started?
Yes, Lake Urema is... As one National Geographic writer called it, the beating heart of Gorongosa. And in the dry season, it's only about 20 square kilometers. In the wet season, it can be 200 square kilometers. So imagine this lake expands and contracts, tenfold. And that's great for a lot of reasons. One of them is that expansion and contraction of the water is what gives us our incredibly fertile grassland that supports so many herbivores. Most trees can't grow underwater, obviously. So having an annual flood creates a grassland. Now that's a normal year, going from 10 kilometer or 20 square kilometers to 200 square kilometers. In the last year where we had the cyclone that I mentioned, it expanded even much more than that. But I'll come back to your important question, which is, are we monitoring that lake and what's happening to it? And yes, we are. There is one concern. What you don't want to happen to Lake Urema is have it fill up with silt. Mm-hmm. And that can happen if there's too much farming or mining upstream, outside mm-hmm. the park, in the water catchment, in the rivers that ultimately come into that lake. And If you get that silt coming down the river and you fill up Lake Urema, that's a real problem. We're watching that. We're measuring that. There's a natural solution that I hope happens, but it remains to be seen. And that is when the hippo population in Gorongosa Park increases again, hippos provide a natural function of keeping waterways running. I mean, they're so big and fat that they just literally, you know, will open up channels, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Hippo population went from about 2,000 before the war down to 100 because they were poached for meat.
Yeah.
I think we're back to about 700 hippos now. So if we can get back to 2,000 hippos, they provide a good function in keeping rivers and lakes stirred up. But this is something we have to monitor. And another solution, of course, is to engage in farming practices upstream that don't put silt into the river. And that's also possible.
Yeah, that's a challenging one to mitigate. I mean, river courses flow through everything and they bring with them all matter of problems, not just the silting, but I suppose also alien plant species like Lantana camara and all those other things that can very quickly and easily dominate a natural landscape.
Yes, we have a wonderful relationship with Princeton University in the United States, and Princeton's had a number of people come through and get their PhDs in Gorongosa studying the dynamics of the ecosystem and who eats what, you know, which of our various herbivore species eat which of our various plants, and what is the new equilibrium that's going to be created. You know, we do have one invasive plant that people worry about. I think it's from South America originally, called a mimosa something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, mimosa.
Yeah. I think the good news, if I'm not mistaken, and I always have to qualify that I'm not a scientist. I just try to listen to the scientists. But I think the good news is we found that our water buck population was keeping this invasive species down. Huh. You know, that's good. You know, and anytime that we can let nature solve the problem, it's always so much better than a human intervention.
Yeah, quite right. It's natural. And you have a massive population of water buck. In fact, that's probably all you inherited when you took over the parks management 16 years ago, 15 years ago.
Well, what happened, during the long, long war, there was, of course, a lot of poaching of animals in the park because people needed to eat.
Yeah.
The water buck were harder to catch because they, in fact, live in marshy areas. And so you can't really set a trap, you know, in water, so to speak.
Yeah.
Or you can't drive your vehicle out and just hunt them. So yeah. At the end of the war, there were just more water buck left compared to impala, compared to bush buck and reed buck and so forth. So the water buck had a head start. But we think that it will all rebalance itself eventually. And the other species are now coming, growing quickly. I mean, our impala population is growing quickly. And so given time, I think the best thing for us to do is just to watch it. And I think given time, we'll get back to a balance where, it's not predominantly water buck, but a mix of species. I think at one time there were 18 different antelope species you could find in Gorongosa, from the really large eland to a tiny little duikers and orabies. That's extraordinary antelope diversity and herbivore diversity. I think that over time we're going to see a rebalancing of all those species.
I think you're absolutely right, Greg. I mean, from what I know, and I'm not the most learned of guys, I have spent a lot of time in the field and I'm a ranger by background, but what I've learned is that, you know, certain species feed on a particular type of grass or browse a certain type of bush. And as that bush or grass becomes overgrazed, it allows space for another species to grow. And as that species grows, it will attract a different type of herbivore. And so you have this mix that slowly starts to evolve. by overgrazing, essentially, or by correct grazing. So, yeah, I think it's definitely going to balance itself out. And that, for me, is the beauty of nature, is it always seems to find its own balance. No matter how much we try and interfere, nature is resilient, and it just keeps, you know, pivoting on that pinnacle.
Well, that's right. And there's something else that scientists discuss called a grazing succession. Meaning that the large animals will come through first, like a buffalo, and they'll eat big coarse grass that nobody else wants. And then when they clear that out, then the medium-sized antelopes can come through, like a Nyala, and they get, you know, more tender grass. And then they clear out a path. And then the smaller species, like an Oribe or something, can come through that likes the little tiny shoots of grass. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, this is another reason that you really do want nature to create its balance, and that, you know, we humans are smart enough to calculate the infinite number of variables going on between the countless thousands and tens of thousands of species. We really do let nature need to sort this out, but nature has a way of doing that. And, you know, I just mentioned the grazing succession among a group of herbivores, but then think about their interaction with insects, for instance. And, you know, someone told me, when I first came to Gorongosa, they said, you don't have many elephants. And because you don't have many elephants, you don't have enough elephant dung. And elephant dung is extremely important part of the ecosystem and all the different species that rely on elephant dung. And then the birds that eat those insects. And, you know, who would think that the number of elephants you have might affect the number of birds that you have? I mean, it wouldn't be obvious to me. But, you know, you can see how connected it all is. And this is why I hope that we never get to a place where we humans think we're so smart that we can design ecosystems. I hear people talk sometimes about the so-called future of novel ecosystems, like, oh, you know, we'll just create these things and so forth. I don't buy it. 4 billion years of evolution has created these natural spaces, and I prefer to let these natural spaces design themselves, and, you know, let's enjoy them. But let's be a little more humble as a species, and not think that that we can have designer national parks. I think we really want to recognize the infinite complexity, and that you need actual wild spaces.
Greg, you are so right. I'm going to sort of wind up now, and I want to make some analogies, because you've spoken about the grazing succession. You've spoken about animals and ecosystems being almost separate to humanity. And I see you as an elephant. You're the primary grazer in this equation. You've come through, you've mowed things down, you've created an environment for succession, you've enabled other species of the human nature to grow and succeed and to become empowered, to become knowledgeable, to become an economic force. You've led a charge which is restoring, I don't want to say restore, you're rebooting a civilization around a natural ecosystem. And we as human beings have been part of this planet for, I don't know, many hundreds of thousands of years, but we've certainly been part of it. We have every reason to continue being part of it. And I see you as being this great visionary, elephant-like, and just having done a tremendous job of creating a plan and a successive plan for that small part of the world. And hopefully people can look in and learn from this incredible model that you've created and copy it and reproduce it in places that are being threatened.
Well, you know, Warren, I thanks for your kind words. But I have to include my Mozambican colleagues in any conversation like this. And, you know, the Pedro Maguras, who know more about trees than I'll ever know, and the Dominique Gonçalves, who know more about elephants than I'll ever know. We've collected an amazing group of Mozambicans, and Gorongosa is now off and running. And as much as I love it, and I'm very happy to dedicate the rest of my life to it, I can tell you that the Mozambicans have got this. And if I slip on a banana peel tomorrow and don't make it back there, I can tell you that the Mozambicans will succeed. It's their treasure. And I'm just honored to really just be one person on a team. And that's really how I see it. But thank you for this exciting hour, Warren. It's been a lot of fun. Thanks so much.
Greg, thank you. And I mean, if we were sitting around that campfire, you'd be getting up now. You'd be changing the log. You might be pouring another cup of hot coffee, Gorongosa coffee, from that lovely aluminium pot. And it's been a great morning. Thanks for joining me. Thanks very much.
All right. Let's talk again soon, Warren. Thanks.
Absolutely, Greg. Thanks, man. Oh, my God.